This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Bill Meeks at MeeksMixedMedia.com and by Violet Microphones at VioletUSA.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
We asked Chris Tarr one of your questions, and here's what he said.
It's base layer topography is almost identical to IP.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
It's your questions and our answers with the usual suspects, Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, and Chris Tarr.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show about radio technology from the microphone, through the studio to the transmitter and up to the top of the tower. We even get into that sometimes. Beacon lights, if you will. Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and with him, joining me this week, the usuals, Tom Ray from New York City. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Kirk. You forgot satellites in your opening.
Satellite dishes too, and microwaves and IP. Oh my gosh! Well, we've got a whole Q and A show that we're going to do today. So, Tom, you're going to be one of our question answerers, aren't you?
I hear my wife calling me. No. Yes, I will be.
These questions are easier than your wife's questions.
Anything is easier than my wife's questions. Let me tell you.
So, Tom, you're with Buckley Broadcasting.
Yes, sir. I'm the Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, and I'm with WOR Radio in New York City.
Also in New York City, Chris Tobin. We'll get to Chris Tarr in a second. Chris Tobin, hi.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm great. And how's New York City?
Today, actually, it was a nice, almost, I'd say, balmy 50 degrees.
I can't wait to get up there and visit you again. I've got a hotel room that's owed to me up there sometime, so maybe this spring sometime we'll get the wife and the daughter and hop on a plane and get up there.
Oh, you must. Spring is a good time. It's very
good time. Yeah, spring is nice there. And Chris Tobin, you are with the folks at CBS.
CBS Radio, 6 radio stations here in New York City, and my job is to make sure the technologies we look at can make some money for us. I'll use the phrase NTR, non-traditional revenue.
There you go, and that's always a good thing for to present to a manager. Also with us, Chris Tarr, also known as the Geek Jedi.
Hi there.
How's the Geek Jedi business?
It's stressful sometimes being a Jedi.
I've also heard the term Ninjaneer.
That is correct. I actually got that from a friend of mine. And in fact, somebody today said, "Oh, I didn't know you were here, but then again, you're the ninja, or you're the Ninjaneer, so I wouldn't hear you coming."
Now, can you be a Geek Jedi and an Ninjaneer at the same time, or must one choose a path?
I think you have to choose a path, depending on the situation. I have to choose wisely as well. So, it's all about how you approach the situation. If you could lay your hands on it and just kind of will it to be better, that's kind of that's kind of the Geek Jedi thing. Now, if you have to attack it, and just be quick and nimble, then that's the engineering part.
Oh my gosh!
Hey Chris, what do you spend a month on batteries for that lightsaber?
Being the Ninjaneer, I've developed a system that takes solar power, harnesses it, and developed a very secret sauce to make it work without batteries.
It's getting thick.
And it's way, because I'm an engineer, it's way overcomplicated, and no one can ever figure out how it works.
It's getting job security.
It's getting very deep. Very deep. And thick.
I don't document anything because that way I don't have to worry about it.
Job security. Yep.
Job security.
Look, Chris, you're the guy for Entercom in Milwaukee, and where else? Madison.
Milwaukee and Madison. We've got 2 FMs and an AM in Milwaukee and 3 FMs in Madison.
Well, I'm sure you have them convinced that they're lucky to have you.
I have them fooled.
Well, no, I didn't say that. All right. We have a Q&A session on tap for today. And so if you listeners, very glad to have you along. And if you have posted something in our Speak Up forum on the website is thisweekinradiotech.com. Yeah, I know that's a lot to type. thisweekinradiotech.com. And the best thing to do is once you get to the website, drag that into your link bar on your browser. Every browser has that. And then abbreviate it as TWRT, This Week in Radio Tech. Now, if you go to TWRT.com, that ain't us. But if you go to thisweekinradiotech.com, that'll be us. You can see a little bit about each and every episode, some show notes on every episode. And then there's also a forum. You can leave notes, leave a comment about an episode, or you can leave a comment in the forum. So we've been encouraging listeners to bring forth their questions, and so we're just going to get right to it. We're going to look at a question from Mark Kroom about the last episode we have, the episode called Skinny and Pissed. And Mark says, great program, guys. The section near the end where you talk about admitting what you don't know and finding the answer really resonated with me. The older I get, the more I realize I simply can't know everything about my stations anymore. Too many stations, too much gear, too many ways for it to go wrong, too much proprietary digital information, digital technology, I should say. A person can't make it in this business without a love for learning. I try to learn something every day, though it's not always from my work. We've got to keep reading, stop watching so much television, continue to cultivate the habit of learning, and that practice comes in handy when the pressure's on, because there's some major failure we've got to rectify, but don't exactly know how. So anyway, Mark says, I don't get to listen to the show each and every time, but I sure enjoy it. So this isn't really a question, but you know what? It's probably worth an additional comment or two. And so I want to hit up Chris Tobin first with this. Chris Tobin, the thinking man in Manhattan, about this subject of never stop learning and don't be afraid to say, I don't know.
Oh, I couldn't, you know, I do it every day. Every day I'm looking at things. It's funny. My wife loves to. Something wacky and crazy can occur on the streets of Manhattan. She will look at me and say, can you explain what just happened? And I'll be like, well, you know what? Believe it or not, I can, because of X. I have learned and practiced not to look at just broadcast-related research. I go outside. I have subscriptions to magazines from military electronics to aviation and space technology. And I find stuff in there that I can actually apply to broadcast. And I find that the more I look at stuff outside the broadcast realm, the more in how would you say, the easier it is to research the question of how do we do a STL over audio over IP connection, or is there a better way to do those Fed Spectrum, you know, goofy dish things that my general manager once in a while say, can we get one of those and save money on the phone company? It's wild. Just looking for stuff and just look at the obvious around you.
So, Chris, you mentioned something interesting. That is, you like to study other disciplines. You're kind of interdisciplinary.
Yes. And it actually works. Many years ago, I was actually one of the magazines I subscribed to, the Military Electronics, which has changed to Space and Aviation Technology, had a complete article on flat panel antenna design used for Inmarsats.
Yeah,
and I'm reading about this. I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool, and the way it works, and you can mount these panels almost anywhere, and the structures around them have very little impact. Wouldn't you believe, 6 months later at NAB, I'm looking at some new, you know, these license-free 5 gigahertz systems, and one of them on display was talking about this new flat panel technology that's going to be available later this fall. And I'm looking and going, wow, and I knew exactly what to ask. The questions to ask the rep on the floor. And he's looking at me like, do you do antenna design? I mean, those questions are somewhat specific, and I haven't had anybody approach me on the floor with that.
Yeah.
And I just said, no, I happened to read about it in a magazine, and the company representing it was X. He's like, that's who we buy it from.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. And ever since then, I'm like, you know, that's it. From now on, I'm just looking everywhere. And with the internet, you can, oh, man, it's amazing the stuff you can find.
Now, Chris Tarr, as both a geek Jedi and an engineer, you know something about interdisciplinary studies.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, even with engineering-related stuff, I read everything, and I spend lots of time online researching things and just, you know, surfing around, seeing what everybody's talking about, slash dot, you know, all the kind of techie stuff. And, you know, another way to look at this, too, is, for example, and Tom Ray knows this, too, because he was on the board of directors of SB, as well as I was, too. But, you know, they also are very big into promoting education and certification. And, you know, for example, when they started to offer the DRB certification, digital radio broadcasting, I was one of the first. And actually, Tom Ray was part of one of the guys who wrote it, helped write it.
I'm the guy who proof-tested.
Well, there you go. And I went and took the first round of testing with it. But it was, you know, I didn't need to do it. And I mean, there was no compelling reason to jump in there and get it. I'd already put in a couple of digital transmitters, but you know, there was so much I didn't know that I wanted to learn and then challenge myself to do that. And so, I mean, it's always a constant thing and you have to want to do it because again, it looks good on a resume or whatever, but it's not like I had to take it or else I would be unemployed or something like that. But it's just that love of challenging myself to learn something new and getting out there. It's it, you know, the person who wrote the post is you know, hit it right on the head. You just, it's going to pass you by if you don't do it, and you've just got to have this genuine love of learning new things. Ooh. And if you can nurture that by going out and doing that, you'll do fine.
It's going to pass you by if you don't do it. That's right. Very true. That's very true.
Right. And you've got, like I said, in order to do it, you really have to be in a position that you just enjoy the process.
Tom, how about you? This notion that you've got to immerse yourself and be willing to say, I don't know.
Something I've always told my kids from day one when they started school was, you know, try to learn at least one new thing every day, because I do, whether it's something to do with one of the IP systems at work, whether it's when you get in a cab in New York and you can't understand the cab driver, make sure you enunciate correctly so when you want to go to 70th, you don't end up on 17th.
70th. Yeah.
but you know, it doesn't matter what it is. You have to love learning. You have to be curious. And like Chris Tobin, I read multiple magazines and websites, and they joke at SBE that because about the only certifications I don't have are the networking, the CBNT right now, and the 8VSB for television, because I don't work in television, but I didn't have to take the certification tests. And what I tell a lot of people who sit there and hem and haw is, like, you know what? Take the test just for fun, because you're going to be surprised at what you know. And that helps build your confidence. I've always told my wife, the day I stop being curious, the day I stop wanting to learn about something, you know, the day I get a new gizmo and don't go, I wonder how that thing works, is the day she better dig a hole outside and put me in it, because that means I'm just not around anymore.
Hey, let's do a let's do a roundtable real fast. Just each one of you tell me in just a sentence or so, what has been your biggest source of learning, maybe even early in your career. And I'll tell you, for me, it was two things. I read Radio World magazine cover to cover, every word in there I read, even the ads, so I could learn about this radio engineering business. And the other thing was, I read manuals. I'd grab the manual for the ITC triple decker, or the ITC 99B cart machine, or of course the transmitter. And, you know, back in the day, they wrote manuals that explained how the circuitry worked. Mm-hmm. So that was my biggest teacher. Chris Tobin, how about for you?
I would say Radio World magazine, definitely, and also the manuals. I still have probably 17 boxes of manuals of all types of stuff. Most of it no longer available, the equipment. But it's for that purpose. Inside the manual, they describe the circuits and how it functions, what to expect.
Chris Tarr?
And broadcast engineering, the original, way back when.
Yes.
You had all kinds of product reviews, and they really talked about.
Back when it covered TV and radio in the same magazine,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Chris Tarr?
All right, two things. One would be, and I wish I could remember the name of it, but an engineering building primer, not engineering, electronics building primer from the library. I kept checking out over and over and over again and building all the projects that are in it.
Yeah.
That was number one. Number two was the NAB Engineering Handbook.
Oh, okay.
I still have actually two different editions of that I carry around.
I could never hold that thing long enough to read it. It's so heavy.
I'll tell you what. The last one that came out, I bought at NAB, and I'll tell you, trying to get that thing back in my suitcase.
Oh,
it's unbelievable.
Security.
Like
security.
40 pounds. Yeah.
Actually, that's a good point. The NAB handbook is right, because I do have several editions, and I have a 1949 version.
Wow.
Talks about how to equalize phone lines with a 111C coil.
Sure, sure. Tom Ray, your source of knowledge?
Well, I think we've all hit it on the head. Radio World magazine. I used to sit around running American Top 40 and read the manuals on the transmitter, and just getting my hands dirty and letting something go boom.
Yeah, I've stuck my hands in transmitters until I found out where all the electrons hung out.
You know what?
Oh, yeah.
One other thing, and Tom Ray will kind of, I think, back me on this one. Another thing that really got me into it was ham radio.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yep,
okay.
That too.
And nowadays, people are generally more into computers than ham radio, but there are certainly engineers who are into ham radio, and a few new people coming along, too.
Which is a shame, because there's a lot of cool digital things going on right now with amateur radio.
Oh, you bet there are. Lots of stuff. I mean, there's nothing like taking 20 watts and sitting there texting with a guy in Stuttgart.
Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff.
I feel like such a wimp, because I just have the no-code tech license, which I guess now it's just a tech license since it did away with the code.
Yep, just a tech license.
But I can hit a local repeater and, you know, tell it to go onto the interwebs and go talk to somebody in Australia
Oh, yeah.
Or England or Canada or Japan.
I'll tell you,
what we have to do is we have to talk you into getting the general now, Kirk.
Yeah,
there you go.
I know.
I actually honestly don't know the code either. I'm a general now, but I actually took the midnight test as soon as they lifted the code.
I've always been afraid that the general test was about like getting a colonoscopy. Is it that bad or not?
It's not bad. I mean, it is difficult, but it's you know, again, it's that learning thing. You know, I studied and I took practice tests and. You know, but I mean, you know, a lot of that is stuff that we do every day in our job. So, you know, for example, like the tech test, I had already been in engineering when I did that. I walked in, took that first try without even really studying. But the general, you know, it took a little bit of work because there's some specific things there and some things we don't do every day. But I think the general concepts you'd have no problem with. I'm scared to death of taking the extra, though.
You know, the extra itself isn't bad. It's just the propagation stuff got, or the propagation questions got me the first time because we don't do.
Yeah.
Propagation for a broadcaster is bad, naughty, no good, you know, interference. And in ham radio, you live for it.
Oh, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
What's kind of crazy is, you know, you get the questions about, you know, SWR, you know, what's an acceptable SWR? And as a radio guy, I'm going 1:1. You know, period. You don't do anything other than that.
Now, Chris Tart, you bring up an interesting point that's at least worth a mention. In our jobs as radio engineers, seriously, we're trying to get a VSWR, a voltage standing wave ratio. This is how much power is being reflected by the antenna back to the transmitter. It's an undesirable thing. So if the antenna isn't perfect, it's going to send some signal back into the transmitter, whether it's an AM or an FM transmitter. More typically, we measure it with FM transmitters. And as broadcast engineers, we're looking for a what ratio? What's the ideal number?
That's 1:1. You want to deliver the entire power to the load.
Okay, so a bad level for a broadcast engineer might be what, 1.1:1, 1.15:1?
Probably 1.5:1 is where you want to really get concerned.
That'd be terrible, yeah, wouldn't it?
1.2, 1.3 is probably typical.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, in ham you do, you know, 3:1, unusual. Throw a tuner in there, you know. Yeah, right. But, you know, we're lighting up TVs all in the neighborhood, and you know.
Now, when we say this ratio, that this is all based on logarithmic, so you can't just take watts forward and divide it by watts reflected, or vice versa, and come up with that number. There's some log ratios involved. But in ham radio transmitting, I understand you guys put up with a lot worse SWR. Yeah.
Well, part of the reason for that is in broadcast we deal with one frequency. WOR operates on 710 and it doesn't change.
And has for a long time. Yeah.
Yes. But with ham radio, I mean the 20 meter band goes from 14150 up to 14.300 or 350, which doesn't sound like a big spread, but you know, when you're dealing with a wire antenna and a piece of transmission line, that's a pretty big spread.
Yeah, okay. And usually, you know, it's only, you know, really resonant at that, you know, that center frequency or whatever. Anything on the sides, it's not. And so you may be putting in, you know, 100 watts out of your transmitter, but maybe getting, you know, 30 watts out of your antenna.
So
that's not uncommon.
Broadcasters are accustomed to getting nearly 100% of the power that the transmitter puts out to go out the antenna. But ham radio guys are not necessarily looking for that.
No, we're looking to communicate.
Okay.
That's all we're looking to do.
I mean, okay. We would love to get that on, you know, across the board, and with tuners and stuff, we can simulate that. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, I want to move on to the next question here. Then that would be from our dial tone episode. A writer wrote in and asked. He said, "I would like to know about TV web or web, you know, watching television over the internet." And he asks, how does shrinking bandwidth impact my ability to get it in a more rural area? And I'm not exactly sure what he means by that. Maybe he means that, well, he's been using an internet connection, maybe dial-up or something else, maybe even satellite that you can get at home, for things like email and downloading a file here and there. But when you go try to use it for watching television, you quickly find out that this dial-up doesn't work for that. It really does take some broadband to get this done. So I'm gonna rephrase his question. He's interested in web TV, maybe other media, streaming audio, good quality, streaming audio, out in areas where there's less than ideal bandwidth. Any idea where the industry's going in that regard?
I think cable companies are doing their best to lay cable or fiber to those rural areas. If not, I think what you're going to see with the fourth generation wireless systems, LTE and WiMAX, probably hub and spoke type arrangements for the wireless carrier, so they can still deliver product or content, but at a cost that they can manage infrastructure wise.
So you
that's
think
my guess.
Even if you live out in the country, when the cell companies bring out, or even non-cells, people like Clearwire, you're going to be, if they bring out WiMAX or LTE, you'll be able to get a reasonably fast internet connection out in rural areas.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Matter of fact, that's the goal of the technology. The radio interface for 4G, LTE, WiMAX is somewhere in the order of like 30 megabits a second or something. Granted, you know, the farther away you are, it's probably going to be less, but anything above 2 or 3 megabits a second wireless is enough to get you what you want. And in the rural areas, wireless local loop, which has been around for eons, can be replaced with this, and they can have, you know, sparsely separated towers and make it happen.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, we heard from Peter Smurden in Melbourne, Australia again, and he participated in one of our shows earlier on. He asks about, or he wants to make a statement about DRM, Digital Radio Mondiale, and how in Australia they have analog broadcasting. They're bringing out DAB Plus, which is a version of the Eureka 147 that hasn't done very well in Canada. It's only done marginally well in Europe, and they think it's going to do better in Australia for a few reasons. But he says that, you know, to really serve the population of Australia, they're going to need something that goes farther, like DRM, which can be placed. There's an AM version, there's an FM version now, and it seems to me, I was reading Peter's email here, that if we in the U.S. could end up with all three of these, and there'd be a lot of simulcasting, but it seems like it sure would be good. It would serve people both in city areas and out in rural areas. Any thoughts on if DRM would ever have a home in the U.S.?
I think it'd be tough. If I'm not mistaken, you know, I mean, one of the issues with DRM adoption here is you can't do the same kind of in-band on-channel type of deal like we're doing with hybrid on with IBOC.
Right. We have HD radio, which for listeners who don't know, works in the same allocated channel that a broadcaster is already licensed to by putting some digital subcarriers upper and lower sidebands of the analog signal. So technically it fits in. Some people say it causes a little bit of interference, but it seems to be basically acceptable. And so we can have this HD digital radio. There are some downsides to HD, which there may also be some licensing and things to pay for with DAB, but one of the downsides for broadcasters is they have to pay for it. They got to pay a licensing fee to Ubiquiti. On the other hand, Ubiquiti is pushing forward pretty hard to get the receivers out there. I mean, there's about 100 receivers out there now, and Ford cars are going to be having HD receivers in them now as standard on a lot of models. I'm sorry, Chris, I'm not sure I interrupted you or not, but
no.
And contrast that with DRM. DRM, you can't put DRM on the sidebands of an FM station. It takes up its own FM channel or wherever you're going.
Well, it takes over the signal, and you have to get rid of the analog.
Yeah, yeah.
To my understanding. Right, Chris?
Exactly. Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do both of them together. There's a whole different, whole different band that would have to run on. And I'm kind of looking here. I have a note somewhere, and I believe it was from Jeff Welton at Nautel, and we actually had this discussion about DRM and why it hasn't, you know, why IBOC and why not DRM and that sort of thing. And I'm actually, as we're talking, trying to find it here. And that was kind of the biggest issue is, you know, even in places where they have rolled out DRM, that's one of the problems with adoption is that you have to go buy brand new radios if you want to get it. It's not one of those deals where with IBOC, where if you don't ever want to buy a digital radio, that's fine because you can still hear the analog counterpart. With DRM, it's an entirely different system and different frequencies and everything else. So you will absolutely have to buy a new radio if you want to hear it. Although on the flip side of that, for example, they have, a lot of shortwave listeners have this software decoders for DRM that use their sound card. And they can plug in their shortwave radio and decode the DRM and actually have it come out as audio.
Yeah.
And I do think that also, if this one I'm not sure about, but I vaguely remember Jeff saying something too about the bandwidth and, you know, some bands transmit DRM better or can hear DRM better than others. But I don't have specifics on that.
And speaking on the the fact that the DRM signal would basically need its own channel, I mean, we just haven't been allocated the extra bandwidth here in the United States. When they were talking IBOC and digital radio initially here in the States, if I remember correctly, someone said, hey, why don't we take the AM and FM signals, put them on a different band? Well, that was taken off the table by the FCC. That was immediately taken off the table by the FCC with the DAB or DAB Plus. That tends to work better in L band. And there was talking about doing that in the United States. However, the portion of L band where they wanted to run this, I think it's the Air Force who has radar up there, and the Air Force said, "Nah, we're not moving. Have a nice day."
Yeah. So, look at how slowly or even not happening Eureka up in Canada. Same kind of situation. So it's like you could move and create a new band to do this simulcasting, but at some point you have to then sunset the analog stuff because you're taking up all this new bandwidth. So it's finding the bandwidth to migrate to and then setting the sunset date, and then you've got digital TV all over again. And, you know, so I really think it's not a matter of, you know, one technology being better than the other. It's a matter of, I think at this point, accomplishing the mission and, what actually works with what we need to do here. And in this case, IBOC was really kind of the one thing that would work because we didn't have to do any moving or migrating or anything else.
So IBOC worked for us politically.
Right, basically.
That's exactly it. It's political.
Yep.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of HD radio, I got to go to the CES show back a week and a half or so ago and met the guy at Ford Motor Company who designs the, I guess they call it the HMI, the Human Machine Interface. That's a term that, as an engineer, yes. I had not known. A guy named Ron Zlotnick. And Ron is so into the driver's experience with a screen-based, touchscreen-based HD radio. So we're going to have him. He offered to come on our show. We'll have Ron on. And I wish we had a video show at this point. I sat in the car with him with some beta software. There are a few things that they were going to change, but the information presented, I mean, it's a lot of information you might want to present, but he presents stations up and down the dial, how many HDs they have, if they have one, or two or three, it was just amazing to see what you could do. And of course, it's all tied into Ford Sync. So you could push a button on the steering wheel and say, tune to a country station, and it would go find the country radio station. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about IBOC and what's kind of promising in the future is that its base layer topography is almost identical to IP. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do with that data, and especially, years and years down the road, if broadcasters decide to shut off the analog component and use the entire channel for digital, there's a lot of bandwidth and it's just data. I mean, the radio sees a data stream. And so you can do pictures, you can do text, there's so many different things you can do. It's all one way, but, I give credit for the people developing IBOC in that they've made it to be very flexible and very it adapts very easily to changes.
Well, thanks for that. I guess that's the upshot of what I was seeing in terms of the finished product or nearly finished product, that this thing could present. And they had some built-in, some dummy data built into the radio. Such as forecasts and advertising and sports scores and what's at the movies. We tie this into your GPS and, you can, quickly find out what's near you and then have the GPS map, in there guide you right to it. So there's a lot of possibilities, but you know what? This seems like a lot of work for content creators. If you think about what an HD radio with a graphical screen is capable of showing you with, from the data stream that comes over the HD station and then tie that in with location-based information from your GPS, I own some stations, and we have enough trouble just coming up with audio to fill the 24 hours a day in a way that's kind of interesting to the listeners. Surely there's going to be companies that come up with content creation for radio broadcasters that let them put, album covers or album art or trivia about an artist or then couponing for businesses that are advertisers. Have we thought about that yet? Seems like there's going to be a big need for that.
We could do that tomorrow. I mean, that stuff's basic.
You think so?
I mean, basic
for the program directors that I know?
Sure. I mean, we've got software that does that now online. I mean, when we play a song on the air, you go on the website, there's the album art, and there's the last five songs we played, and, you know, that sort of thing. I think that's pretty easy. I think where it gets exciting is for, you know, just a tip of the iceberg now is what the Broadcasters Traffic Consortium, which is a Intercom and Emmis and a couple other groups, have gotten together with NavTech, and NavTech actually, you know, we just provide the delivery method. NavTech pays us, and they're doing, you know, GPS with, you know, real-time traffic. And I can tell you that I'm sure they've got some other plans going on with the HD version of that. And, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily think that we'll be the content providers here. And I think that's kind of what's interesting.
So you're saying
that's going to be the revenue for us.
The link providers.
Right. I think that's where that's coming from.
One of the interesting demos that Ubiquiti used to show in the early days of HD radio, when they first came out with the technology to put an LCD screen on the radio, was a baseball game. And,
oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, well the guy get up the bat. They basically put his baseball card up on the screen. They had a dime in there. They'd show you who was on first, who was on second. The guy would hit the ball. You'd see who was going to catch the ball. Oops, the guy made an error. Where it went. You saw all this on the screen while the play-by-play was going on. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Huh. Remember the idea that I'm sure other companies have it by now, but at a couple of NAB shows, Gene Novacek from Enco showed some real-time audio-to-text technology.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember that box.
And the idea was it would actually allow radio for deaf people.
Yep.
So you could, if you wanted to listen to Dr. Laura or Rush Limbaugh, then you could tune your HD radio in, and assuming that the station or the network would have one of these voice audio to text converters, you would get a display of what Dr. Laura said or what Rush Limbaugh said, and you could read it on your radio.
That was actually an offshoot of their technology for closed captioning.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's what the technology is intended for, real-time closed captioning.
But you could take it and adapt it to HD radio, and you're right, radio for the deaf.
Switching topics. Have any of you ever heard of this myth in television audio that all the mic cables that come from the anchor desk, okay, the sports guy, the two anchors, the weather guy, that all the mic cables need to be tied into a common knot?
Well, that works only if they're gold plated and they're in the right, and they're going in the right direction.
Yeah,
and the
copper and the cables oxygen free.
The myth is that this will keep the audio in phase when the mixer opens two adjacent mics, say lavaliers, that are on the anchor and the sports guy.
I think that'll work a lot better if pin two is always hot and pin
bingo. Yes, it matters how the internal strands are wired to the connectors and the mics.
And also the distance
between right
the microphones
too.
and the room acoustics, the distance to the countertop and reflective surfaces. Yeah, there's a few things, but you know those knots, if done tightly, prevent those phase errors from passing through to the anchor.
And if they're tied really tight, it prevents those dumb comments from the anchors.
That's right. You don't want the audio to get there too fast, so you got to put that knot in there to kind of slow it down.
You want to match it to the video.
If you do double knotting,
that's a video sync.
It's a delay line. Come on.
Exactly.
You're like 10 of them. You've got your 8-second delay.
So,
we're going to see Kirk next time. He's going to tell us next time he does the weather on Channel 17 there in Nashville. He's going to be checking his mic cord before they take the air.
Probably for
My mic cord is 2.5 feet long. It just goes to a pack on my belt.
Well, there you go. You make sure the battery's in right.
There you. You put the battery in wrong, and the phase is reversed, right?
Well, no, actually, what you're supposed to do is the belt pack is supposed to be is horizontal to your belt. That way, your body now becomes part of the antenna, preventing a phase shift.
Ah, how that works.
There are a lot of myths like that.
So, have we debunked this myth about television audio?
Yes.
Yeah. Matters not if the cables are tied.
There are many things about television audio we can talk about, but I guess we'll stick to this one.
All right. Well, another question from Peter Smurden, and he had asked this some time ago, and I'm not sure how well we really covered it. I guess what I'm looking for you guys for on the answer here is give us some rules of thumb for handling audio that's going to end up getting coded in different ways. So maybe a cell phone caller calls in, and so there's audio coding going on that digital cell phone link. And then maybe you're recording this into your automation, and maybe your automation system is using either APTX or MPEG layer 2 or 3 or something to record. Or maybe it's linear. And then maybe your studio transmitter link may be some coded audio, or maybe it's linear. And then what about when we transmit it over, say, HD radio? There's some pretty powerful bitrate reduction going on there. What are your own rules of thumb about how to best avoid issues, audio degradation because of coding several times in different ways?
Keep the coding to as little times as possible. So if you only have to do it twice and don't do it any more times than necessary. And what you should do is start playing around and see which things play nice together. For example, AAC plays very nice with HD radio. MPEG layer 3, I call it a halo around the audio if you're listening to the HD signal on AM at least.
So you're saying if every other path in your signal chain is linear. Let's say your studio to transmitter link is linear, and Tom, I'm guessing yours probably is.
Yes.
And actually, many broadcasters, especially big city broadcasters, have linear links to the transmitter site because it's affordable in a big market. But Tom, you're saying if your source material or a contribution was in MP3, even at a reasonable bitrate, when that of course is decoded, then sent through your linear stuff, and then re-encoded in the HD radio codec, you're saying that doesn't play so well as if the source material came in as AAC at a reasonable bitrate.
Well, we found with the layer 3 stuff that if it's at least 192 kilobits or higher, it doesn't sound bad. What really sounds bad is when you get down into an ISDN codec that's running at 56 kilobits. And like I said, it sounds like if you could see it, there'd be a halo around the audio. That's the way I envision it, because there's almost like this ringing going on, but you can't really put your finger on what's the matter.
Yeah.
Where the AAC plays nice. And let's face it, you're going to have, you're going to have this transcoding going on because of the remote broadcast and everything else. So the idea is to keep it to as few times as possible and maybe do some experimentation to see what plays nice and what doesn't.
I think also, too, it's important, especially nowadays with levels and things like that, because, if you can give the codec plenty of audio to work with, the next codec in the chain. If you can feed that with plenty of audio, it has more to work with. So you want to fill those bits up as much as you can, yep, and give it enough data to take out to reduce it. So if you're already, you're going to have messed up source material, and all other things be equal, one of the most critical things you can do is at least make sure that, you're sending enough of that audio down there so that at least, it'll try to take some things that it can take without, really messing your audio up.
Try to go with the highest bit rate you can from the source to the end.
I'll tell you a little story, and I hope I haven't told this before, of my first experience with audio processing revealing the shortcomings of bit rate reduction. Now, when I say for our audience, when I say bit rate reducing or bit rate reduction technologies, I do mean MP3, MP2, AAC, or APTX. Anything that takes a linear signal that is typically about 2 megabits per second of data to represent a good number of samples, like the audio on a CD is about 1.5 megabits per second. If you sample it at a higher rate, like 48 kilohertz, and you do 24-bit bit depth, which is now much more standard than 16-bit. Then you're looking at about 2 megabits per second worth of raw data to represent to linearly represent the audio. When you knock this rate down to a much lower rate through perceptual audio coding or other methods like APTX uses, then you end up with less data that's supposed to still represent what the original audio was. And of course, some of these technologies are very scalable, like AAC can get on down in the neighborhood of 24 kilobits per second, or HEAAC V2 can get down to, 12 or 16 kilobits per second. And they can operate at higher bit rates, too. AAC can easily do 384 kilobits per second, and so can MP3. If we use these much higher bit rates, where we're only cutting the data down, I say only cutting the data down by about two-thirds or three-fourths in terms of bit rate, if we're coding, say, at 384 kilobits per second or maybe 512, all the research I've seen says that this audio is nearly unimpeachable, that no matter which codec you're using, layer 2 at 512 kilobits, layer 3 at 384 or so, AAC at 256 or so, APTX at 256 or 384 kilobits. This audio is pretty unimpeachable, and you can do a lot to it later on down the chain, and you'll be okay. Of course, if you have the chance to be linear, that's fine. And that brings us to the point of, say, automation systems, where, they all used to encode the audio to keep the file sizes reasonable on the hard drive. Now, back in the days when a 9-gigabyte hard drive was $1,000, you know, we had to, you know, compression technology was cheaper than hard drive storage technology. But nowadays, that when, you know, hard drive, I've got a thumb drive here that's, you know, 8 gigabytes, and it costs, I don't know, $32 or so. So you see where we've gone in technology from the $1,000 9-gigabyte drive. There's no reason to have audio compression in certain parts of the chain now, and a automation system is one of those nowadays, and a STL is, you know, for many people is one of those places too, where you can keep it linear at a reasonable kind of cost. So the point I was getting at is if you do audio processing, and all radio stations are going to do that, it's amazing what multiband aggressive audio processing can bring out in terms of artifacts. With the guys at Fraunhofer, when they develop you know, these various coding schemes, and other companies too, they don't really intend for you to do intensive real-time multiband audio processing, leveling and limiting on the finished audio. They intend for you to hear it naturally with your ears, and when you do that, well, most of it sounds pretty good, even at slightly lower bit rates, like MP3 at 128. If you don't process it afterwards, it actually can sound sound okay. But here's the, I'm getting a long round of the story I was getting at. Years ago, we had a satellite service of the Tom Joyner Morning Show on one of the radio stations that I owned at the time. And it was delivered to us, over satellite link at, I think it was 192 kilobits per second, and it was MPEG layer 2. Well, 192 kilobits per second is a little on the slow side, for MPEG layer 2. MPEG layer 2 would do better at 256 or 384. And at the time, we had, you guys remember, an old Orban 8000 audio processor on this FM station, which is a nice, pleasant, smooth, wideband audio processor. It's not multiband. It's not doing anything terribly aggressive to the audio. And you know what? The station sounded just fine. We never knew that there were any coding issues with the audio that we were receiving from ABC at the time. Well, we put on a multiband audio processor. It happened to be an Italian one that's no longer in business selling those processors, but we had this multiband audio processor on a demo. We put that on the air, and we sounded awful when we were on satellite, and we sounded just fine when we were on CD. So I really got to playing around, and this is when it just occurred to me, bright as day, you know what, if you take an MPEG-2 signal that's been coded at 192, and you process it really hard to, you know, bring up the loudness and the punch and the bring up the bass and, you know, just make everything really forward, you're going to bring out all those artifacts. So have you guys found anything similar to that? Has that been your case as well?
I'll tell you, I upgraded our automation system. We were using APTX for years and years and years, and about 2 years ago, we put in a new system and went to uncompressed waves in the audio. And you would have thought we just spent a ton of money on new processing. I mean, it was literally night and day difference. And you begin to realize, like ABTX, you were lucky to get 15 kilohertz audio out of that on a good day. And, you know, to go to uncompressed waves from there. And especially now back in the day, as you were mentioning, now, if you had like an Optimod 8000 or even an 8100, they typically rolled off, you know, 13, 14, 15 kilohertz is all they passed. So you really couldn't, you know, there was no difference there. But, you know, with a modern processor like an Omnia or modern Optimod, they'll go out to 17 kilohertz on FM. And, you know, that extra little audio there makes all the difference in the world. And it was like this veil got lifted out from in front of the speakers when we went to the uncompressed waves.
Well, I think as much as or even more than the frequency response of the audio processor, what's getting through it is just the aggressiveness of the individual bands. I mean, you take a modern Orban or Omnia processor or any aggressive multiband processor that's going to make you stand out on the dial. Even if it's well adjusted, I'm not talking about something that's been cranked around and to the point of not sounding good on the air. But it's going to take these little artifacts that normally would be below the perceptual level, and it's going to bring those up, bring those forward. And that's one of the reasons why it's really important to avoid audio coding except where you have to have it to get the signal back. Agree? Disagree?
I would agree with that. The problem is it's become so easy to do MPEG encoding nowadays. It's become the preferred method because of ease of use.
That's
the drawback. But at our facilities, we do our best to ensure if we have to do anything with coding, go with the highest bit rate possible that the path that we're taking will allow. And for the most part, we find that it works well. We can't control what comes in from the outside, cell phone calls for contests or interviews. One thing we did discover, or I discovered working, tinkering, if you will, is how a lot of folks will like to process the output of a hybrid audio because the program directors think it sounds better, the phone callers.
Yeah.
Well, I've discovered that the more and more we use digital cell phones and the way they have to make the channel work for the phone, the more you process that audio, the more you bring up the artifacts and the noise floor that's inherent in the vocoders.
Oh, yeah.
And it actually becomes difficult if the contester or contestee has background noise going on, if they're outdoors or at an event, sporting event or music event. It's just subtle things like that now I'm noticing more and more. We have to sort of back away from processing these audio paths.
Tom, you found the same thing with transcoding of calls on WOR on your HD, didn't you?
Not necessarily the calls. It was with all the remotes we do.
Oh, okay.
The surprising things, like, for example, we'll use a Comrex Vector. Surprisingly, that sounds pretty good with the HD signal.
Uh-huh.
Like I said before about the MP3, that sounds a little funky. The AAC stuff sounds great. So it all depends. And every now and then, one of the producers picks up some MP3 file they pull in and just to throw a quick music bed or something. And it's like I sit there and cringe whenever I hear it because they don't pay attention to what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, but the biggest thing with mm-hmm. this transcoding and everything else is convincing the program director that with when you're dealing with bit reduced codecs like an HD radio, convincing him that loud is not always better.
Yeah. Something that has occurred to me that when MP3 first became popular for broadcasters, and I'm thinking of when Mosley, the STL company, made a digital studio transmitter link, and they made it work by coding the audio. And I think you had your choice, either APTX or I thought it was MPEG Layer 3, but I could be wrong. And I remember listening to this coded audio at a demo at the NAB, and I thought, wow, this sounds really good. I can't tell the difference in the linear, in right off the CD and having gone through their STL. Well, I want to say my ears weren't very well trained back, 12 or 15 years ago when I first heard this. And now, as engineers, I think we have learned very well what coding artifacts sound like, and our ears are more attuned to them. But it's a different kind of distortion than the distortion that we've been used to for years, whether it's wow and flutter from a tape or the vagaries of playing back of audio from vinyl. It's a whole different kind of distortion. And it's taken years for this knowledge and perception of this distortion from too low bitrate codecs to enter our psyche, to enter our daily world.
And, back when Mosley introduced that STL, there was nothing else like it on the market. And actually, you had a choice. You could get a version in MPEG or you could get a version in aptX.
Yeah.
And, very frankly, with what we had for source material back in those days and what we were running for, what some of us are running for analog pro.
Hello, Tom? Well...
Uh-oh. Sounds like he was about to upset somebody and they cut his line.
Who'd like to finish his sentence? Tom, we lost you. We'll try to dial you back here. We're drawing close to the end of the show. Hey, while I'm trying to dial back Tom, here's what I'd like to think about for closing the show. Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, think about some of the more common, or think about the most common question that you're asked either by your staff or by listeners that you have gotten good at answering, that you have a good way to provide an answer to help the people understand what it is that that you were trying to explain. Think about that. We'll try to bring Tom Ray back in. And it looks like lightning hit his house or something, because we're not getting Tom. I'll start. And that is by explaining about audio processing. Have program director typically will say, "Hey, we're not as loud as WXYZ or KBCQ. We're not as loud as them, and we need to be." And then I have to go through the process of finding out, well, is it something that we're doing wrong? Are we actually, not printing on the dial as well as we are allowed to by law? Are we not modulating enough? Is some of our source material dirty, and so I can't process it as hard as I could if it was really squeaky clean source material? And so I guess from my point of view, one of the most common things that I get asked, this would be the Q&A part, that I get asked from program directors is, how do I sound as loud or louder or better than this other station on the dial? And so often what we find, of course, is that the other station is illegally overmodulating. And, in this day and age, you kind of pick, well, how much am I going to overmodulate? Am I going to stick right at 100%?
Right.
Am I going to go to 105%? Am I going to go to 110? And how am I going to measure that modulation? Because, there are several different methods of measuring an FM station's modulation. And you might want to do it the way that the FCC does it, for example, with a calibrated
Bessel null.
With a Bessel null, and don't they look at an oscilloscope and see if there's any peaks that go past a point? Whereas if you have, I think Tom may be back coming back online here. If you have a modulation monitor, a typical commercial modulation monitor, it may be oversensitive to peaks. In other words, it may show you your peak light may come on more often than the FCC would care about or would require. So you got to kind of figure out, okay, how much over the speed limit do we want to do, and which speedometer do we want to observe? And then, as I alluded to before, let's look at the source material. Quit getting the music director to get his songs from Kazaa or LimeWire, or even from iTunes. Let's get linear music, if at all possible, on every song we can. Let's establish a better relationship with our record company, if we still have relationships with record companies. I don't know. So that's a common question I get asked. That's my common answer. And in the long run, we're usually successful in at least getting up to par with the competitor. So
that's not too far off. I mean, I've been asked that question on many occasions, and I've been asked the question of, we're not loud enough, or we don't have a certain signature sound, or something is just not right. And then I try to explain to the programming folks and sometimes the disc jockeys who are involved with the programming folks. And I say, well, what is it you're trying to accomplish? What is your audience? Where are they listening to the station? What exactly do you want to do? And then I look at the whole system from the start of the music insertion all the way through. And, the first thing I always tell them is, how about we get the levels out of the automation system somewhat consistent? And then we can really get aggressive with the processing and still sound open but loud. And then I get accused of being a purist. It's like, no, we can't do that. I was like, well, that starts, because if you have one song louder than the other or the next going into the compression, the processing, guess what? You're going to destroy the way your settings are. So I try to work with them on that level. And then once they somewhat accept that and go, okay, that makes sense, then we go toward the processor and we start looking at how to process. And I say, which station do you think sounds the best or close to what you want? I find out what they're doing. It's real easy. And then I say, okay, we can easily mimic that and go one step more. But you're right. The key is the modulation speeding, whether you're speeding or not. And being in the New York City market, speeding is something people are always very conscious of. The fun thing is with FM, if you do it right, you can actually sound really loud and not be over-deviating the carrier because of the algebraic method by which FM stereo functions under.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
If you get into the mathematics of it. I've done it. It actually works really well, and it's pretty fun. But That's the trick. I just look at the carrier deviation and make sure that I'm, you know, within, what is it, the two subcarriers you could do, was it 110%?
I think the
ratio.
Yeah.
If I can stay within that deviation window and sound competitive, meaning, you know, loud, whatever it is we're trying to achieve, then I know I'm covered as far as somebody inspecting or some competitor saying, those guys are speeding, go after them. So, you know, the other thing, too, is every market's slightly different as far as what is loud and what is not.
Yeah. So, Chris, it sounds like your experience with a common question you get has been very similar to mine. And, yes. Tom, you were offline for a sec when I asked this question. We're wrapping up the show by making up your own Q&A. What's something that you get asked frequently by either your staff or by another engineer or junior engineers that you need to explain to them that maybe our audience would appreciate as well? Chris Tarr is going to be next, Mr. Ninjaneer. What do you get asked a lot?
You know, actually out here, especially in the Midwest and with the flatlands and everything, we get a lot of problems with atmospherics messing with our signals. And very often, it'll be spring or fall when things are real active with ducting and things, and our signals will be horrible. And so for the first question I get is there something wrong with the transmitter? And, of course, there never is. And, you know, so I have the standard answer.
Because you're the engineer, that's why.
Because I'm the engineer. You know, but I also have, you know, and I actually have an email that I save that every time these things crop up, I send out to people who ask, that basically explains, you know, FM propagation and how ducting, you know, how ducting affects that and things like that. And I always go, well, okay, you know, yep, you're right. You know, your mother, you know, the next town over can't hear the station. But what'll be interesting is here's a guy 400 miles away right now who's enjoying it. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you'd be surprised. I mean, in the years that I've done this, that is a very, very common question.
Boy, that, you know, that's a good point. That's one that I have been asked often too. Hey, usually I get the station just fine over at, you know, Smith's Crossroads.
Right.
And this morning I couldn't. I was hearing some other station, or our station just sounded really bad. And you referred to that as interference by ducting. Is that what you said, Chris?
Yeah, it's typically, I mean, out here especially, and we're also by Lake Michigan, which, you know, creates some things too. You know, we get a lot of times, you know, on a warm day in the summer, stuff from across the lake just booming in. And, you know, so yeah, I have something that's kind of pre-written on, you know, why that happens and, you know, that there's not much we can do about it and that sort of thing. But it is, the other funny thing is usually they don't believe me. Are you sure that there's nothing wrong with the transmitter? I'm like, listen, if there's anything wrong with the transmitter, you know, I wouldn't be here talking to you. You know, I'd be gone working on it. So, you know, you know, cause it's gotta be the transmitter cause I can't hear you. So that's a very common one, especially out here. You know, with the flatlands and you know, the ducting, and it really gets bad in the summer, especially where we'll have, it's not so bad with the class B's, but like we have our class A's, in Madison that are, you know, kind of rim shots in, and they just get destroyed, you know, in the big city there. So, that's a very common one.
Boy, if you want to know something about atmospheric ducting, just, go to Wikipedia and, look up atmospheric duct. And there's it's not a long
and also,
article, but there's
usually when that happens, it means I'm also going to run out to my car on 2 meters on the ham band. And
you're going to use it.
I'm going to use it. I'm going to get out there and make some long distance contacts too.
Well, you know, when we first moved up here to New Windsor many, many moons ago, it was before the DirecTV offered the local channels, and we're far enough out of the New York market where you have to have a real big antenna to get the New York TV station.
Oh, you're talking about at the Casa de Rey.
Yes. And okay. My wife would constantly complain in April that she'd sit down to have lunch and turn on the TV to watch the news in Channel 2 and would be watching Channel 2 in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it would just come screaming up the coast in one of these ducts. And that would happen at least for a week, and it would happen every April like clockwork.
And the weather forecast looked wonderful. She thought it was great.
Oh, yeah, she thought it was wonderful. But then when her soap opera came on, she'd get real bent out of shape.
Yeah,
anyway.
I'm sure the Channel 2 in Orlando probably has a different soap opera on, one that she's not interested in.
Exactly.
So, atmospheric ducting. So, Tom, is there any other question that you tend to get that you'd like to provide an answer for now?
Actually, I get two, and the first one is, how come in what should be WR's coverage area, and actually it's just outside of our normal contours, why is there a Spanish station there, especially on Long Island? And that's a station on 710 in Cuba that just comes screaming up the coast.
Oh, it's farther south, but Long Island would be basically northeast of your transmitter sign. Right?
No, it's actually west. It's actually direct east of the transmitter, and we push about 160 kilowatts in that direction. And people on Long Island, once you get out to about midway on Long Island, all they're hearing when the Cubans are on the air are the Cuban station. They cannot hear us.
Right. Remember, Long Island is about 125 miles long, and about three-quarters of it reaches out into the Atlantic and is a clear shot south. There's nothing to fear.
So and going west towards our transmitter site, it's all rock and New York City.
Yeah. So if I leave Cuba, whether on a boat or a radio wave, I can hit Long Island.
If you head north, you bet you would. Yeah. You will if you head directly north.
Okay.
And the other question I have is why when there is heavy snow, we have to or heavy snow and ice. Why do we have to reduce power on WOR? And that's because our towers have detuning skirts for the other stations. Chris's station 1010 Winds is one of the stations we detune for. And the skirts and the insulators all get coated with ice, and that will change the tuning on the entire system. We have to reduce power because our readings go all over the place.
Oh, so you don't have to reduce power just there for your own transmitter because of the ice maybe changing it. Because ice doesn't usually change AM parameters on a standalone AM very much, but you've got all those other 50 kilowatters close to you.
And we've got we've got two detuning skirts on the towers.
Two, okay. So there's a lot of RF theory going, theory and practice going on there.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, Kirk, I can change turn a knob on my coil in one of my doghouses, and I can have Tom take a look at his phase monitor, and I can wiggle it back and forth.
Yep, and same with me, and same with Chris. I can do the same thing.
Yeah, I did that one night with our consulting engineer about 3 years ago while we were working on some repairs, and I forget who I called. One of the guys out there in the swampland. I said, "Hey, you guys doing some work tonight? Yeah, do me a favor, look at your phase monitor for a quick second." And I sat there, we started spinning it. He's like, "Whoa, got a little interaction." I said, "Where are you?" He's like, 3 miles north of me. That's how much interaction takes place out there with all the AM stations.
So, transmitter sites in the Meadowlands. Each one has to have detuning skirts to get rid of signal from the others.
Well, no, WOR has the skirts. We're the tallest tallest set of towers out there, so we're overly tall at 1010.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But still, adjusting one set of towers miles away affects another set of towers.
Oh, you bet.
And
it's funny, whenever we have to put somebody on a tower, we have to ground the tower. Of course, that negates everything. So I call Chris. I call, I make half a dozen phone calls. Hey, guys, we're going to be detuned for, a couple hours today. We're going to short the tower. Okay. we can tell when somebody's doing work.
Oh, yeah. When they're doing construction, the cranes roll in. I get a call from the studio. Hey, the readings are fluctuating all over. Something must be wrong with the STL link or the remote control. And sure enough, we turn on the camera, take a spin of the neighborhood and go, oh, look, 300-foot crane. That's why. That's just the way it works.
Wow. Well, guys, we've been at it for an hour, and I sure appreciate your participation. I've learned a few things, certainly, and this is, listeners, this is where your questions go to. We picked out all that we could felt we could answer this hour. So if you have more questions, things you've always wanted to know about audio, about how to handle audio, or maybe even how to wire up an audio console, how to get audio from one place to another, whether by streaming or whether by some kind of an RF link.
By car, by boat, by train.
That's right.
Or how to handle operators and the program director like the bat in my office. But anyway, yeah.
Are you guys saying that engineering is about half psychology?
More like 100% psychology.
98%.
And 2% smoke.
Fake out the electrons, huh?
And a little black magic as well.
Oh, here's one for everybody. Yeah. Have you ever heard of anyone talking to you about audio processing using theta waves in order to lure listeners to the radio?
Using what?
Theta. T-H-E-T-A.
Theta waves.
Yes. Oh.
That's interesting, though.
I recently have been had someone talk to me about that, and if I was familiar with it, because they said that TV does it with commercials, and that some radio stations he's worked at, the engineers have actually tuned the processing to take advantage of that. And I'm doing my best to say, wow. Okay. I've heard of strange things with psychoacoustics, but I don't think Fraunhofer ever talked about theta waves.
Or how about the mosquito repellent tone? Or is that
Yes.
Yeah.
No, but I'll tell you what got my attention during the football game, during the ads in the football games. Did you guys see the Walmart ad with the guy with the clown costume?
Oh, that was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I was on the floor because my wife looked at me and she said, I can see you doing this.
This ad would surely be on YouTube, wouldn't it?
Oh, it's gone viral. It's great.
Yeah, there's we can get a link for the site. It's viral.
It's one of the funniest ads you've ever seen.
Huh. Walmart ad with a clown. Ah, there it is. Yeah, if you just go to YouTube and search for Walmart ad clown, there you go.
See, stuff like that gets my attention. Forget the theta waves.
well, you know, I'm just the theta waves, though. I did look it up after I was asked this question just to make sure I wasn't, like, blowing this guy off and going, you're an idiot, get out of here, you're crazy. There is research done. It's called binaural tones or binaural beats. And this effect was discovered back in 1839.
What frequencies are your
frequencies? Well, that's the best part. The frequency tones they talk about for beating together to be heard is 1,000 to 1,500 hertz, 1,000 to 1,500. However, the difference between the two frequencies must be small enough, below 30 hertz, for the effect to occur.
I'll tell you what makes me, the frequencies that make me sleepy are anything below 92.1, so. Sorry, did I say that? Sorry, I didn't mean that.
Oh, there goes our public radio audience.
I can't.
FDR is going to start sending Kirk hate mail. Come on.
Now they're going to come after you. I'm going to come to my car. It's going to be tire slashed and a tow pack sitting on the antenna.
I get enough hate mail, guys. Well, listen, I'm out of here. Tomorrow I'm on my way off to India, to Delhi, for the BES convention. I'll report on anything new there. They're going to award 700.
So you're saying you're going to New Delhi?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know the difference between Delhi and New Delhi. They're just different parts of the same place.
Well, you said you'd report on something new, so we figured it was New Delhi.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Whew, all right. We should all keep our day jobs, especially you, Tom.
When I replace Conan, you're going to be jealous.
Yep, I will be.
He's already been replaced. It's too late. They already got somebody for his job.
Did we ask you?
Listen, let's not bore the listeners anymore. Thanks for joining us for This Week in Radio Tech, and we are very glad you were with us. Tom Ray.
Yo, yo.
Thank you. Chris Tobin.
Best wishes to all.
And Chris Tarr.
Adios.
Tell your friends and tune in again next week for another This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.